From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Former special counsel Robert Mueller is testifying before Congress today. He began this morning before the House Judiciary Committee looking at his investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election and possible obstruction of that investigation by President Trump. Here's part of Mueller's opening statement.
Over the course of my career, I have seen a number of challenges to our democracy. The Russian government's effort to interfere in our election is among the most serious. And as I said on May 29th, this deserves the attention of every American.
Well, Mueller is now speaking before the House Select Committee on Intelligence, which is taking up Russian interference. NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas joins us now. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
And can we just briefly sum up the hearing that just passed? Democrats did get Robert Mueller to say he did not exonerate the president of obstruction, as the president repeatedly claims he did. Republicans attacked the entire investigation. What struck you the most?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. One is that this went largely according to script. We knew that Mueller did not want to discuss at length what was in what was outside of his report. He wanted to stick to the report itself, and he stuck true to that. He did not get into long exchanges with lawmakers. A lot of it became monosyllabic yes or no answers. Democrats, I thought, early on in particular, did a very good job of getting the sort of answers that they wanted from Mueller in the sense of, did your report exonerate President Trump? Mueller says no. That is a win for Democrats. I think that Republicans spent a lot of time competing with each other to get a good soundbite attacking Mueller and his investigation. But ultimately, bottom line, that went largely according to script, that whole first hearing.
Well, let's listen to a little of that, because they attacked the genesis of the investigation. They went into what could be weeds for some people, maybe not, for instance, for viewers of Fox News, because this is very much, you know, a conversation, the how this investigation was started. They brought up the Steele dossier, for instance. This was the information put together by a former British spy, first commissioned by Republicans to attack then-candidate Trump. Then when he became the party's candidate, they dropped it. It was picked up by Democrats. Here's the Republican Greg Stube of Florida.
And I am asking you directly, did any members of your team or did you interview Christopher Steele in the course of your investigation?
And I am not going to answer that question, sir.
You had 2 years to investigate. Not once did you consider it worthy to investigate how an unverified document that was paid for by a political opponent was used to obtain a warrant to spy on the opposition political campaign. Did you do any investigation in that whatsoever?
I do not accept your characterization of what occurred.
Ryan, this happened over and over and over again. Republicans have thought this through. What was their goal here?
Well, what we heard in this instance and then with a number of other allegations from Republicans were the lines that we have heard over and over for really the past 2 years. And that is a long-running attempt to try to undermine the Mueller investigation and any conclusion that it comes to get at kind of raise questions about the origins of it and whether it was politically motivated. The matter of the Steele dossier, the fact that it was picked up and, well, the fact that it was essentially funded by the Democratic National Committee, by the Clinton campaign, and used at a certain point in time as part of the justification to get a surveillance application on a former Trump campaign advisor, Carter Page. That has all played into, fed into this large Republican narrative that there are questions about how this investigation was run and allegations that it was essentially an attempt by Democrats to take down Donald Trump.
Yeah. Well, so this morning, as you say, and others are saying, Democrats did get Mueller to repeatedly say the president was not cleared of obstruction. Now we're looking at Russian contacts, potential contacts with the Trump campaign and Russian interference in 2016. Some of the analysis we're hearing is that this committee on intelligence, maybe Democrats on the committee might have more of an eye to 2020 in talking about Russian interference. What's your thoughts here about what we might hear?
Well, I think that this committee, because Democrats want to focus on Russia's interference as opposed to obstruction of justice, is going to get at something that Robert Mueller has been more forthcoming about and more eager to talk about, and that is what the Russians did to try to undermine U.S. democracy in 2016. And it's something that he warned about the only other time that he's spoken publicly over the course, well, actually since his investigation began. It was actually he spoke in May after he had closed everything. But he emphasized then, and he emphasized in his opening statement today before the House Judiciary Committee, that he has a very long career in public service in the U.S. and the challenge of Russia's interference in the U.S. elections in 2016, the challenge that poses to this country, to the United States, is very serious, and it's something that every American should care about.
Yeah, and what might the Republicans be asking here? Because, again, the topic is supposed to be Russian interference.
Well, if the opening statement of the top Republican on the committee, Devin Nunes, is any indication, we may hear a lot of attacks on the Mueller investigation, who worked for it, steps that they took, because Nunes came out of the gates with guns blazing.
Yeah, so more attacking the investigation than the Russians who interfered. NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lewis. Lucas, thank you.
My pleasure.
And a science story now about genetic screening. These popular tests can tell us a lot about ourselves, from where we come from to our risk of developing disease. In Nevada, researchers are collecting this personal information in the largest health study of its kind in the world. Noah Glick from member station KUNR reports.
I meet up with Jordan Steitler in a Reno coffee shop. She's a mom to a 2-year-old boy with another kid on the way, a girl. She recently got some interesting information about her family.
I'm related to Jesse James, the outlaw, which I think a lot of people are. It's kind of weird.
Steitler discovered this connection after she took part in what's called the Healthy Nevada Project. This statewide initiative asks participants to provide a sample of their saliva to determine a genetic blueprint. In return, they get free ancestry results and a genetic health screening. It's how Steitler discovered that, in addition to some interesting relatives, she has a genetic disorder called familial hypercholesterolemia, or FH. Basically, she has high cholesterol that's unaffected by diet and exercise.
We're not, like, dwelling on it. We're not upset about it. Like, it's just something that I have, and we're gonna fix it.
Since getting the results, she's drastically changed her lifestyle. She's switched to a plant-based diet and exercises more regularly now to avoid making her cholesterol level even worse. But the real finding for her has to do with something a little more personal. Steitler lost her dad about 10 years ago, the victim of a stroke at age 45.
I always say that we felt like my family was kind of cursed because, you know, there are men who are passing away really young, and it's scary, and we never really truly knew why, and this could be why.
Genetics offers a lot to the basic researchers.
That's Dr. Joseph Jimsky. He's the principal investigator for the project.
And now we're finding that it's really important in a clinical setting.
Jimsky says the project started as an idea between the state-funded Desert Research Institute, an environmental research organization, and Renown Health, a Reno-based not-for-profit healthcare network. Together, the two wanted to understand how knowing your genetic information could help improve health by changing your behavior.
And that, to me, is the trillion-dollar question.
Jimsky says he hopes this project will increase research infrastructure and funding so his team can answer bigger questions about how genetics and environmental forces interact with each other. For now, the study is looking for 3 gene variants that are linked to colon cancer, high cholesterol, and breast and ovarian cancer.
For the 1.25% of the population that has one of those 3 conditions, we could do something about it before it's too late.
The Healthy Nevada Project kicked off about 3 years ago. It has around 50,000 participants now, but its aim is to eventually reach 1 million people across the state. Anyone can sign up, which is what makes it the largest community-based population health study of its kind in the world. But it's a lot of personal data to have on file.
This doesn't get more personal than your DNA.
That's Dr. Anthony Slonim, the president and CEO of Renown Health.
So we have in the project a tremendous responsibility in assuring that we are protecting that with the utmost care.
To do that, the project has added several security layers. Slonim says no one involved in the project has access to both genetic data and personal health information. And unlike direct-to-consumer genetic tests like Ancestry.com, participants in the Healthy Nevada Project are protected by a certificate of confidentiality from the National Institute of Health. That means law enforcement and other entities can't get access to the information. Slonim hopes this protection encourages more people to get involved in the study, and that means more data.
This provides us some insights about the issues of our community, not today, not tomorrow, but 10 years hence.
DNA sequencing company Helix provides the genetic analysis for the project. Co-founder Justin Cao says genetic testing has gotten significantly cheaper. That means these kinds of tests can be done more.
It's just another data layer, just like your annual physical, just like an annual cholesterol test, where it's another data point your physician will use to help keep you healthier.
Cao sees a future where physicians could search your digital genetic profile to find the right mix of treatments and medications based on your specific genes. Participant Jordan Steitler sees a future with less heartache.
If it could save a family from going through what we went through, then I think it's totally worth it.
Even though she misses her dad, she says finding out about her condition has given her some closure and motivated other family members to get tested. For Here and Now, I'm Noah Glick.
And Noah's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau. You're listening to Here and Now. Still looking for a great summer read? Well, maybe one you can peruse while you pick at a lime Jell-O mold salad with marshmallows and shredded carrots is Ali Rowbottom's Jell-O Girls, recently out in paperback. Yes, the book is about Jell-O and girls.
Do you know what makes a little girl happy? Twinkling Jell-O. There's nothing quite like Jell-O. It's a wonderland of delight.
But Jell-O was anything but a wonderland for the women in Ali Rowbottom's family, who inherited the Jell-O fortune, millions, and what they said was the Jell-O curse. Ali's grandmother, her mother, and Ali all felt forced to be as perfectly molded as a Jell-O dessert. She traces the history of Jell-O. Her uncle bought the patent in 1899 for $450. The family sold it years later for $67 million. Her family members suffered alcoholism, eating disorders. The town of Leroy, New York, where Jell-O was made until it suddenly wasn't. And Women in the Kitchen. The cover of her book shows an orange Jell-O mold with what looks like a Barbie trapped inside. Again, Ali Rowbottom's terrific book is Jell-O Girls, A Family History. We spoke last August. Well, you begin the book almost at the end, you taking care of your mother as she dies from the cancer that's just tortured her almost her whole life. And as she's dying, the only thing she can eat is Jell-O, which she hated and avoided her whole life. Talk about the irony there.
At the end of my mother's life, she accepted it, but for much of her life, she avoided Jell-O, seeing it as sort of a symbol of patriarchy on a broad scale, but also of her own family's struggle against patriarchal forces and against what they thought of as a Jell-O curse. So at the end of her life, when it turned out that Jell-O was the only thing that she could stomach, it was this sort of grim irony. Unfortunately, it wound up being the last thing she ever ate. Mm.
Talk a little bit about Jell-O, because there's a storyline here. It's kind of the history of food in America and new domestic science technology. You know, you just put in hot water. So simple, even a child can do it, which, of course, infers that women at home doing this are childlike. But talk about how it was sold to them in this idea of domestic science.
Well, Jell-O's marketing really took hold around the onset of the Industrial Revolution. Many American women were losing a lot of their help in the kitchens to factory work that was more lucrative and probably more rewarding in a lot of senses for people who had previously worked in the kitchens of the middle classes. So many American women were finding themselves unsure of how to prepare the recipes that they had grown used to eating. But Jell-O came around and sort of had a double hook in that it was so easy to prepare, but it was also this new scientific food at an age where America was really privileging science and technology. It compelled its audience.
Never mind that it had dyes and more sugar than, you know, and made from what, the hooves of animals?
Now I think it's made more from boiled hides and skins, but at the time it was rendered from hooves and bones.
And women were encouraged to do what with it?
It could be a breakfast, but it was also a salad, but then it could also be a dessert. So it was very versatile and it really molded itself, if you will, to people's palates.
Well, early on, Jell-O commissioned Norman Rockwell to illustrate cookbooks and advertisements. Interesting, because when your mom is actually committed to an institution, there's a rumor that Rockwell is there as well. And he did, we now know, have a lot of mental health issues. So your mom wasn't the only one who couldn't adhere to this perfect image that Jell-O was presenting to the world. But bring us to the point that your mother came to, that Jell-O makes women silent.
My mother very overtly felt that Jell-O and sort of the larger American culture that it served as an icon for did contribute to what she saw as a patriarchal culture that contributed to silencing and oppressing women.
Well, and talk about your mom and her story, which you clear-eyed tell. She was molested by friends of her brothers when she was a very young girl, lured into having sex with what sounds like a lecherous married cousin, then, as we said, went to the Austin Riggs Mental Hospital at the age of 19. After that, was, you know, you could say promiscuous in her life that she was trying to craft, getting away from the family and its fortune and be an artist in her own right. What was that like to write about?
It was a really moving experience, honestly. I mean, I started this book before she died, but it really wasn't until after she died and I experienced grief and loss that I really understood why she had behaved the way she had for most of her life. For example, on birthdays and Christmases, she would send us presents from her own dead mother. I always found that strange, and now I completely understand it.
Well, her mother died so young.
Yes, and I think all of my mother's behaviors could really be traced back to that initial loss. And like I said, it really wasn't until I lost my own mother that I understood that about her, and I could look at her memoir that she left behind with a whole new perspective.
Because she had wanted to write the book that you ended up writing.
She had. She had tried for much of my life to write a memoir of her girlhood and adulthood and to braid in this idea of the curse of patriarchy and how it connected within her family and how it probably, in her mind, connected in most women's lives.
There's so many characters in here. Jell-O's a character, your mom, of course, your grandma. And also the town, Leroy, New York, where Jell-O was king. And then when Jell-O left the town was decimated. But you trace that fall in Leroy to another storyline in your book. You and your mother were captivated by a news story that we remember of a group of young girls in Leroy who had an inexplicable outbreak of something that nobody could describe. They had tics. They couldn't control their limbs. This also happened in Leroy, the home of Jell-O. What do you conclude about that?
So the girls were initially a mystery and later diagnosed with conversion disorder and mass psychogenic illness, conversion disorder being the conversion of emotional trauma or stress into physical symptoms, and then mass psychogenic illness being sort of tagged on to the end as the mysterious spread of these symptoms through groups with no real reason for it having spread. So that was the resultant conclusion that doctors made through a process of elimination. My mom really felt that these girls were very obviously responding involuntarily to a culture that was particularly strong in Leroy of silencing women. And so as she and I both knew through our own experiences, when one's voice is silent, oftentimes the body finds other ways to speak.
Well, and for you and your mom, you had this mysterious, like, paralysis of your hands. They would, like, shape into a claw.
Yeah, that had happened to me before I knew that it had happened to her. And it wasn't until much later when I went back through her memoirs that I saw that.
How do you draw the Jell-O curse to your own storyline, which is you had a serious eating disorder? At one point, you were only eating sugar-free Jell-O.
Yeah, so I think that like the girls in Leroy and like my mother before me, a lot of my struggle traced back to not feeling free to speak once I started to speak and express myself in therapy and to learn that it was safe to do so. My symptoms became less present.
And by the way, one of the things you couldn't speak about was that your father was having an affair with one of your teachers, but told you that what you were seeing with your own eyes wasn't true. Boy, it gets intensely personal. But again, as we said, also takes a step back and looks at the history of Jell-O. And there's another irony here, because when we think Jell-O, we think this guy.
We're here to celebrate a different way to eat Jell-O gelatin. With our bare hands.
It's just so interesting to be reminded that Bill Cosby was the voice of Jell-O for decades and turned out to be someone who also had repressed women.
Yeah, as the face of Jell-O, he, on the surface, projected this equal parts daddish and infantile persona. But as we know now, he was really also the face of a certain kind of tradition of silencing women or working to keep women silent.
Well, he allegedly gave them knockout pills.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What have people said to you about this? Jell-O holds such a place in people's minds. Have they been upset about how you've cast it? Or what are you hearing?
Well, first of all, I've heard a lot of wonderful stories of people's childhood relationships with Jell-O. I've been gifted recipes. I've been gifted old cookbooks. A lot of people don't see this book as portraying Jell-O necessarily negatively. I will say that there are some people, maybe connected to LaRoy, who don't feel great about the book. It's a challenge as a writer to write honestly of a place or a person, but also to, you know, not portray it as any one thing.
And how about you? Do you feel you have broken the Jell-O curse?
I hope so. I do feel that, you know, I have sounded my voice and my mother's. It's a constant challenge, I think, probably with anyone who puts a book out into the world, but for this book in particular, to stand behind my work and to stick to my guns when, you know, there are many who are coming forward, or some who are coming forward, I should say, who are proving the point of the book in some ways and trying to shut me up. So I think it just proves the importance of work by women that challenges the norms that we still live with and norms that would see us stay silent.
Allie Rowbottom's book is Jell-O Girls, A Family History. Allie, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jell-O Girls author Allie Rowbottom. The book is now out in paperback. It's here and now.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that's designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Emberwave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, in restaurants or theaters, after a workout, at home, and more. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, own your temperature.
Special Counsel Robert Mueller is in his second House committee hearing of the day, the House Intelligence Committee, charged with focusing on possible Trump campaign contacts with Russians interfering in the 2016 election. It was part of Mueller's report. Here is Mueller with committee chair, the Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff.
Apart from the Russians wanting to help Trump win, several individuals associated with the Trump campaign, we're also trying to make money during the campaign in transition. Is that correct?
That is true.
Paul Manafort was trying to make money or achieve debt forgiveness from a Russian oligarch?
Generally, that is accurate.
Michael Flynn was trying to make money from Turkey?
True.
Donald Trump was trying to make millions from a real estate deal in Moscow?
To the extent you're talking about the hotel in Moscow?
Yes.
Yes.
When your investigation looked into these matters, numerous Trump associates lied to your team, the grand jury, and to Congress?
Number of persons that we interviewed in our investigation, it turns out, did lie.
Mike Flynn lied?
He was convicted of lying, yes.
George Papadopoulos was convicted of lying?
True.
Paul Manafort was convicted of lying?
True.
Paul Manafort was, in fact, went so far as to encourage other people to lie?
That is accurate.
Manafort's deputy, Rick Gates, lied?
That is accurate.
Michael Cohen, the president's lawyer, was indicted for lying?
True.
He lied to stay on message with the president?
Allegedly by him.
And when Donald Trump called your investigation a witch hunt, that was also false, was it not?
I'd like to think so, yes.
Well, your investigation is not a witch hunt, is it?
It is not a witch hunt.
When the president said the Russian interference was a hoax, that was false, wasn't it?
True.
And earlier today, in front of the Judiciary Committee, Mueller defended his decision to not rule on the question of obstruction of justice. He referred lawmakers to his report after many questions, including questions about the origins of the investigation. He was asked numerous times whether President Trump could be prosecuted after he left office. Former Special Counsel Mueller answered yes. But he sidestepped the question of impeachment. Here he is with Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner, the Republican of Wisconsin.
Is it true that there's nothing in Volume 2 of the report that says that the president may have engaged in impeachable conduct?
Well, we have studiously kept in the center of our investigation our mandate, and our mandate does not go to other ways of addressing conduct.
And Mueller was asked by the Arizona Democrat, Greg Stanton, about the criticism that Mueller was politically motivated.
Some people have attacked the political motivations of your team, even suggested your investigation was a witch hunt. When you considered people to join your team, did you ever even once ask about their political affiliation?
Never once.
In your entire career as a law enforcement official, have you ever made a hiring decision based upon a person's political affiliation?
No.
I'm not surprised.
If I might just interject, the capabilities that we have shown in the report that's been discussed here today was a result of a team of agents and lawyers who were absolutely exemplary and were hired because of the value they could contribute to getting the job done and getting it done expeditiously.
Some sounds from today's House hearings with Robert Mueller. We'll continue to follow them throughout the day. You're listening to Here and Now. So you say the news is getting you down. You just can't get away from it this summer. Well, how about being transported by music? The German early Romantic era composer Felix Mendelssohn is perhaps most famous for A Midsummer Night's Dream, which he wrote when he was 17. And then there's the Wedding March he later added to it. Felix Mendelssohn and his sister Fanny, who was also a composer, were musical prodigies. Last Thanksgiving, when we asked our classical music expert, Fran Hoffner, what music she's thankful for, she said Mendelssohn. That's Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony, which he wrote when he was just 24. For Fran Hoffner, the music not only evokes Italy, it is like going on vacation.
Listening to this makes you immediately feel like you are not where you are. And it maybe helped that I listened to it when I was on vacation.
Yes, in the Catskills in New York, upstate.
Yeah.
So beautiful. Not Italy.
No.
But what? Like, how were you listening to this? Walking around in earbuds? How was it coloring you?
I was staying in this old schoolhouse, actually, with these big picture windows looking out over the mountains. And it was quiet hours on our little trip. So I decided I wanted to just listen to something. So I put on my big noise-canceling headphones. And I put on the symphony almost as a spur-of-the-moment decision. I hadn't heard it in a couple of years. And I just sat and looked out the window for a little and listened to it. And had this profoundly moving experience listening to the symphony and imagining this like same joy that Mendelssohn and I both shared while being on vacation.
Let's listen to a little more. You say it swept you off your feet. You know what I love about talking about classical music with you? Some might say that this piece is kind of caricatured. You know, they've heard it over and over. But then thinking about looking out a big glass window at upstate New York or anywhere across the country, the Grand Canyon, you know, prairies, I hear it again.
Yeah. I think there's a really emotionally mature experience being projected here with the music, even though Mendelssohn was so young when he wrote it.
Let's listen to the Andante. Some musicologists call this portion mournful, but you don't. Let's listen to a little. I think this you listened to while you were walking in the rain.
Yeah, I took a little walk after I listened to the symphony for the first time, and I was like, I think I want to listen to this right over again. So I took a little walk into the mountains, and it was drizzling slightly, but not such that it would really bother me. And it just sort of had this, I don't know, it's a little melancholic, but I don't think it's too dire or too mournful. And there's something, I don't know, it's like sometimes you have bad weather days on vacation and you just gotta get through it.
Then we go to the third movement, Con Moto, with motion. Describe this as we listen.
I think Mendelssohn has allowed a lot of space into this particular movement. The first and the fourth movement are sort of frantic and joyful, and this one is so indulgent in its joy. This is where it really all sort of like clicked into place for me on this re-listen.
You say the piece is free from the tyranny of brass. we'd like to speak to some brass players.
Yeah, get oh no, there, they're going to come for me.
But they do, there's a muted horn trio, which then can take the listener by surprise.
Yeah. It's so, I don't know. It's like stumbling upon something you didn't happen to come across. It doesn't really like interrupt the motion of it. It's almost as if you, the listener, discover it rather than Mendelssohn placing it there for you.
This is a genre of music from this era. Tell us more about that.
Composers were no longer using music to explore form necessarily, but now just emotions and memories and little stories. So while there are some like folk dances embedded into different parts of this, there's sort of a reference to Faust perhaps in the second movement. This is calling to mind all sorts of different emotional ideas rather than experimenting on just a theme.
Okay. The fourth movement, Saltarello, is after an Italian folk dance. So let's listen. You say this is almost maniacally cheerful.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just this full burst of energy, like trying to get in all the last things you want to do before the end of the day or the end of a week on a trip. I can feel sort of him rushing to get this out.
Well, and he wrote his sister, Fanny, that what, this, it was going to be jolly?
Yeah, it was going to just be one of the most joyful things he's ever written, and I think it's really true.
But then there's the very, very end.
Mm-hmm.
Let's listen. And all vacations come to an end.
They do. And I think this ending is a little dark. I think it's a little sad. It's sadder perhaps than, you know, the second movement, which was thought to be based on, you know, a funeral march. Mm-hmm. I think there's this disappointment kind of projected onto the end of this. It doesn't rise to this really emotional, happy, triumphant, you know, cymbals, timpani, big brass ending. It sort of just like ends.
Ends. Look, Mendelsohn grew up in a prominent Jewish family, brought up without religion, baptized as a Christian at age 7, out of favor musically for a while, partly because of anti-Semitism. Talk a little bit about how he was viewed.
Well, this was a really contentious time, I guess, as many were to follow, for Jews in Germany. And I think Mendelsohn really had a lot to overcome that I don't know that he did in the time that he was composing. Mm.
Which didn't last very long.
Yeah.
I mean, how old was he when he died?
38. Yeah. I think of him the way I do Mozart. They're like the two young M's to me, because he also had this really prolific, youthful career.
Yeah. Felix Mendelssohn died at 38 from a series of strokes. His sister, Fanny, at 42, mm-hmm. also from a stroke. So we listened to his music even more closely, knowing how young he was and what more there might have been.
And I think the idea of writing about yourself on vacation is kind of, I don't know, like not a particularly original idea or not a very mature idea, but the actual music that he composed has a real emotional maturity about being in motion that I really connect to.
Classical music expert Fran Hoffner writes for WQXR in New York. Our Mendelssohn Musical Vacation first aired last November. Enjoy. It's here and now. Lead poisoning from Flint, Michigan's contaminated water got national attention and action. But lead poisoning from other sources has been an entrenched issue in many cities for years. Cleveland is one of them, with a lot of old houses built before the 1978 lead paint ban. The city is grappling with how to fix this problem, but in the meantime, parents worry about the known health effects of the toxin on their children's brain development. It's possible the brain can compensate. One thing that might help? Reading. WCPN's Ann Glosser filed this report.
What's this?
Mouse.
Yeah. I see a nose on every face. I see noses every place.
About a year ago, at 1 year old, Eden Tobik was found to have a blood lead level of 19. Any amount of lead is harmful to young children. 5 is the threshold of concern. Her mother, Casey Tobik, was devastated.
Shock, guilt, shame, fear, despair, terror sets in, and then you Google it. And it gets even worse.
They didn't have chipping paint, just an old house in Lakewood with friction surfaces causing lead dust that Eden must have ingested as she crawled around like any normal toddler. They took out a loan to make their home lead safe and were told to give Eden healthy foods and a multivitamin. But other than that, doctors had nothing else to offer her.
It was very much a, this is it, let's just watch and wait and see what happens, which as a mom is like the worst thing you can hear from a medical professional because you just feel helpless.
If I have a child with lead poisoning in front of me, I would never say to the parent, it's hopeless.
That's MetroHealth pediatrician Dr. Robert Needleman.
We don't know in your individual case what that lead may or may not be doing. But what we do know is in every case, if you talk with your child and listen to your child and have conversations and read books together and learn together, your child will be smarter and have more self-control and behave better than if you don't do that.
The key is to remove the source of lead exposure and provide a nurturing environment where learning can happen. One-on-one conversations and interactions promote healthy, strong brain connections.
Those kinds of conversations cause the brain to grow in positive ways and essentially combat the negative effects of lead.
While the cellular damage of lead is permanent, Needleman and other experts say the young brain is highly resilient and they believe it can compensate for the loss.
If one part of it isn't working very well, other parts can take over. And also, it's growing. It's not finished.
Needleman says reading offers one of the best ways to help the brain bounce back from lead exposure, which is why he helped start the National Reach Out and Read program, where doctors give books to patients and encourage reading. Looking at pictures, naming objects, hearing, and sounding out words all fire up important connections in the brain. University of Cincinnati researcher Kim Dietrich was part of a 2015 CDC working group that reviewed the scientific literature on ways to help lead-exposed children.
The idea, the concept that children who are exposed to lead
early on are a lost generation is completely fallacious.
Dietrich thinks reading is an excellent strategy for helping lead-exposed children, but he and others in the field, including Needleman, acknowledge that there isn't perfect scientific data on its effectiveness. And it wouldn't be ethical to do a perfect study. You couldn't ask some parents to not read to their lead-exposed children just so you'd have a control group. Case Western Reserve University's Rob Fisher is planning a new study to gather some data about programs that get books into the hands of children with lead exposure. Fisher recently co-authored a study that found that high-quality preschool, which would have, in theory, a lot of reading and one-on-one attention, didn't help lead-poisoned kids catch up to their peers. But there's nuance to their findings.
We see in the evidence that there are lead-exposed children who are on track at kindergarten and that are on track at third grade. What's allowing them to overcome that adversity? It's very possible that something like reading and parental engagement in the child's life is the success factor that allows that to happen.
And one thing more, suppose no nose, where would all our glasses sit? They'd fall off, just think of it. The end. Another one?
For Casey Tobik, reading is something she would have done anyway, but she's encouraged by the messages of resiliency.
I am in a much better place than I was. I've sought out medical professionals of varying degrees. Everyone at this point is reassuring me that we caught it early and that, you know, her system is resilient and she will most likely not have any long-term effects because we caught it early. We got rid of the lead in her environment quickly and her levels have gone down drastically.
And at last count, Eden's lead levels are down to 3.3, below the threshold of concern. For Here and Now, I'm Ann Glosser in Cleveland.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.